got a question about this. Can we use the fact that the homology group is the quotient of two groups which are both like which are both what is it called co-cycles, even though we don't know what they are?
You mean for H2s or for H1s?
For HN.
HN.
Because it's in the text.
Sure, that's okay. Yeah. It's described really quickly in any standard reference, so I think that's okay.
You might want to give a reference to that, like 7 report.
And you're arranging
just write the first few pages of a TIA wall as a reference for this fact, where they do it explicitly.
They're in the like cycles.
Mod code boundaries, yeah.
That are grouped under addition.
Well, I
yep.
Stamps.
So does anybody else need the notes for today?
Handouts,
we already
new
handouts.
No,
this is new.
Oh, then I need it.
On the last page, you'll find the homework for next Thursday. And,
the last one?
Probably. Probably the last homework assignment, but I don't want to guarantee that until next Tuesday. I might think of a really good problem next Tuesday. But probably I won't give you another one, and you'll have more time to work on your projects by not having a homework assignment. Also, I'm going to Bristol, England tonight, so I won't be here to teach on Thursday, but Andre Joyce is going to talk about the implication weak mortal vein plays strong mortal vein. So if you know E of K mod N, E of K is a finitely generated abelian group for some integer n greater than 1, then you can conclude that E of K itself is a finitely generated abelian group, assuming that the torsion subgroup is finite. So he's going to discuss how to do that using height functions. So that will be on Thursday. What we're going to do today is a tiny bit more basic group cohomology, then some basics of Galois cohomology, then I'll talk about Kummer theory for number fields, and finally Kummer theory for elliptic curves. And Kummer theory for elliptic curves, you'll see a sketch of a proof of the weak mortal vein theorem there. And it's most of the details are actually there. It's a sketch, but there's nothing that you don't... There's only one thing, I think, that you don't really already know that goes into the sketch, which is a fact about if you take an elliptic curve over field K and you have a prime of good reduction, you have a reduction map to the reduced elliptic curve. And... for certain integers n, you can prove that this map is an injection. And the proof of that is somewhat involved and involves working with formal groups and developing a theory there. And that I will skip. But it's a nice, clean statement, and it is something that you could understand if you were to just look at the appropriate references. That's the one, really the one non-trivial thing that I'm going to skip. But pretty much all details of weak mortal vein besides that are given in the notes for today and possibly for Tuesday. I don't know how far we'll get today, so... it could be that we'll finish this up next Tuesday. Okay, any questions before I get started? All right, so first we'll begin with the inflation restriction sequence. And here's the situation. You have a group G and a G module A. And as last time, there's associated to G and A a whole bunch of cohomology groups, HN, G, A. And this association, HN, GA, is in a way we discussed last time, it's functorial in the second variable. That's to say, if you have a map from A to B, you get a map from HN, GA to HN, GB. So you have some functorality in the second variable. There's also functorality in the first variable. I won't say so much about it except to discuss a special case. So suppose you have a subgroup H of G. Then the G module A is also an H module. Since if G acts on A via automorphisms, then H will also act on A because you just restrict the action of G to an action of H. So you get, in addition, cohomology groups H and HA. And you'd like some sort of natural maps between these two cohomology groups. And in fact, you have them. There's a res map, which goes from res h, it goes from hn, g comma a, to hn, h comma a. And this res map is nothing, all it is if you view an element of hn, g comma a as an n cocycle, it's a map from a product of copies of G to A, then you simply restrict the N cocycle to a map from a product of copies of H to A. And you get an induced map from that product of copies of H to A, and that's a cocycle. It'll satisfy the same condition because you're just considering the condition that defines a cocycle on a subset of the original product. So you get an induced cocycle, and that's what res is. It's restriction of a cocycle from here to here. And we're only going to actually use this in the case n equals 1, and then there's just one factor in this product, and you know the definition of cocycle is a map from g to a with the property that f of sigma tau is equal to f of sigma plus sigma f of tau for every pair of elements sigma and tau in g. So if you restrict a function like that from g to a to a function like that from h to a, you certainly get another function which has those properties. And there's more on the last page. So that's what res is, and it makes sense in general for any n. Here's another special case. Suppose that n equals 0. So if you have an element of a that's fixed by g, then you get naturally from it an element of A that's fixed by H. You just take that same element. So there's a map like that. The fixed points for G, that's a subset of the fixed points for H. Since H is smaller, there's just more fixed points for G than for H. So that's one map that you get from this inclusion. There's also another map in the other direction, which is called inflation. And this goes from it's not really in the other direction, but it's a related map, G mod H, and then here we have to make a module over G mod H. And what you do is you take the fixed points for H acting on A, then this is a module for G mod H. Here we have to assume that H is a normal subgroup for this to make sense. So assume H is a normal subgroup of G. Then, of course, H still acts on A. If you take the fixed points, then that's acted on by G mod H. And you get this group cohomology. And this has a natural map to, called inflation, to Hn H comma A. So I guess it's in the, it's not really in the opposite direction, it's in the same G comma A. Well, it's in the opposite direction, because the domain's different, but the codomain is switched. So you have an inflation map in H. And here what it is, on the level of cocycles, let's just consider the case n equals 1. So a cocycle is a map from G mod H to AH. If you have a map like that, you can consider it via the projection map from G to G mod H. Well, it induces naturally a map from G to AH, and that map will be a cocycle. It will still satisfy the cocycle condition. If this map satisfies the cocycle condition, then the composition will satisfy the cocycle condition. That's something you have to check. Probably it's checked in the notes. Let's see. No. But it is true. So this is a cocycle, and so you go from having, in general, an n cocycle from G mod H to AH, you get an n cocycle from G to A, just by using the projection maps from G to G mod H. So
how do you extend this to the non-fixed part of A?
Use the inclusion from AH into A. Any map to AH is also, via this inclusion, also gives you a map to A.
Oh, so
and
it's not surjective.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
It's not surjective in general. So you get very special cocycles in the image of this inflation map. And you might wonder, what do you exactly do you get in the image of the inflation map? And that's what proposition 12.3.1 is. That's the infrared sequence. So it says that if you have this setup where you have a normal subgroup, H and G, then, well, you have an kind of a natural exact sequence to consider here. First you have H1 G mod H on the AH. Then you have H1 G A. Now you have res. So the first map is inf, and the second map is res. And then you have H1 H comma A. And the proposition says, in fact, you have an exact sequence like this. So first, inf is an injective map, always, from H1 to the other H1. And second, the image of inf is exactly the kernel of res. So res measures the failure of inf to be surjective. So it's a very important basic exact sequence that you use extremely frequently in grouping Galois cohomology, especially Galois cohomology. So we'll get to it in a minute. Galois cohomology is just group cohomology where the groups that you consider are Galois groups. So there's this exact sequence. Before I discuss the details of how to prove this, let me make a few remarks. Notice that I only have a 1 here, not an n. So this is not true if you just put n's here. You don't have an exact sequence like that in general. What you do have, well, first, a way to extend this, and in general, this is not exact on the right. It's not a mistake that I forgot the 0 over here. It really can fail to be surjective on the right. And there's an example in the notes. Example 12.3.2 has a really simple example where you have failure of surjectivity on the right. So it really can fail. So a natural question to ask is, what happens? Can you extend this sequence? And you can. So just as an aside, before I prove something, and this is not something I'm going to prove, but before I prove something about this, the correct way to extend the sequence is as follows. So remark, there is an extension of the sequence, and it goes 0, then H1, G mod, this is the whole thing with the appropriate extension. We have inf, H1, G, A, and we have res, H1, H, A. And in fact, there's an action of the group G mod H on H1 HA. If you take the fixed points of H1 HA under that action, then that fits into an exact sequence that goes like this, and then you have H2 G mod H A H, and then H2 GA, and then it stops. So you have a somewhat longer exact sequence like this in total generality. And this map right here is called transgression. And if you know anything about spectral sequences, you might realize that here this is an H0 of an H1. And the way you prove this is using spectral sequences. Because, I mean, notice that this term right here, this is just a hint that you're going to need spectral sequences. That's what this is. Okay, so that's one way to extend this result. Another way is if, see, I think it's if this is 0, make sure that's right. Yes. If this is 0, then you get an exact sequence exactly like this, but with 2s instead of 1s. Just that's what's true. If this is 0 for all exponents, so h1, h2, h3, up through hn, then you get an exact sequence like this with n plus 1. So these are the generalizations of this statement. We won't need any of those generalizations for this class. So I'll just discuss how to prove this. And a complete proof of this can be done given just what you know right now. And in the notes, there is a complete proof, which I essentially copied from page 117 of Sarah's book with some changes to make it fit better with this class. So there really are. Well, one thing is the composition is 0, so that's pretty easy to see. So remember, we're going to think explicitly about 1 cocycles. that is maps F from G to A that satisfy a certain property, or maps from G mod H to AH that satisfy a certain property, modulo co-boundaries, where a co-boundary is a special co-cycle got by taking sigma of, you know, alpha minus alpha for some element alpha in your module. So the first thing to check is that the image of this is the kernel of that. And then also you have to check that this map is injective, and also that the image, let's see, what else? I guess that's it. So that's what exactness says. It says this map is injective, and its image is equal to that kernel. So the first thing we'll do, which is really easy, is just notice that if you first inf and then res, you get 0. And the reason for that is if you inf, so you start with a map from G mod H to AH, and now when you do inf, you're considering the composition like this. And then when you do res, you're restricting to the subgroup H. Okay? So if you start with a map, just any subtheoretic map from G mod H to AH, then extend it to a map from G to AH via just that extension, and then you restrict it to a map on H, you're going to get the zero map. Because, after all, every element of H is in the kernel of this map, and the restricted map is just this composition. Okay, so the composition of these two is the zero map. So that's the first thing to check in verifying the inf-res sequence. Now, there are two other statements which aren't quite as easy. One is that inf is injective, and the other is that the image of inf contains the kernel.
We already showed that the image of inf is kernel.
No, we contained it. We showed the image of inf was contained in the kernel just now. We showed every element. We showed the composition of these two is zero. So what this showed was that res composed of inf equals zero. Here, we showed that this composition is zero, but you need more. You need kind of the other direction. So this only shows that the image of inf is contained in the kernel of res. And we want that the image of inf contains the kernel of res, so you have equality. So let's choose one of the two and prove it, and then I'll let you read the other one. So everyone vote for, hold one hand up if you want to see one, and two hands up if you want to see two.
Have we only seen one?
Yeah, you only get to see one in class. You have to choose. And then you can read the other one.
Two is the hardest.
Two is
showing that
image
is in the kernel.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Two it is. All right, so we're going to skip one, the fact that this map is injective. So we're only going to show that the image of inf contains the kernel of res.
So we want that image of inf contains the kernel of res.
So suppose we have an element f, and that defines an element of H1. That is to say, something in here that goes to zero when you restrict it. So suppose f from G to A is a one cocycle such that res HF, res H of the class of F is zero, i.e., F restricted H as a function from H to A is a co-boundary. Okay, that's the assumption. Now we have to show that in fact comes from an element under inf. So what does this mean? It means that there's an A in H such that F of tau equals tau A minus A for all tau in H. Not for all tau in G, but for all tau in H.
You mean A in A?
Yes, thank you. Not in H, but in A. There's an A in A. There's a little, let me call it alpha for the black.
It's A and A sound the same.
So f of tau is tau alpha minus alpha for every single tau in H. And our goal is to show that f comes from an inf.
So here's what we'll do.
We're going to take the coboundary defined by alpha. That's a coboundary on G. So let's see, let G sigma equals sigma of alpha minus alpha G. So using that, from G to A, defined by alpha. Actually, let me say the coboundary G to A defined by alpha. So this is an element of the one coboundaries for G comma A. So it's an element of B one G comma A. Okay. Now we'll subtract that off from F. Remember, F is a function from G to A, and it just happens to be the case that when you restrict it to H, you have a coboundary defined by this element alpha in A. And now you certainly can consider f minus g. Okay? Now notice that on h, so if you take a tau with tau in h, so tau here is an h, then this is equal to f of tau minus g of tau. But on h, f of tau is tau alpha minus alpha, and on h, I mean on all of g, but in particular on h, g of tau is tau of alpha minus alpha. So this is zero. So the difference, f minus g, that's a function that is zero on h. Okay, so now there's a little more trickery here. So so let's just simply replace f by f minus g. Because f minus g, it's another one cocycle, but it's equivalent to the cocycle defined by f. So if we can show that f minus g comes via inflation from h1 g mod h h, then we'll be done. So replace f by f minus g. So we may assume f of h is equal to zero. So I've changed the cohomology, the representative for my cohomology class by a coboundary. G is a coboundary, so I'm allowed to do that. That's the equivalence relation that we're working modulo. So we have f of h is equal to zero. So now we can start over. We have, think about it this way, you have a cocycle, f from g to a, and when you restrict it to h, not only just as a cohomology class do you get zero, but the function f restricted to h is the zero map. And then you can forget about all this. That's the situation we're in. So we're taking something in the kernel of res, and we've now shown that you can represent it by a cocycle with the property that when you restricted h as a function, it's the zero function. Okay, now let's consider the definition of, or the defining property of a cocycle, and f is a cocycle. So the defining property is that f of sigma tau is f of sigma plus sigma f of tau. So remember that f of tau is zero as long as tau is an h. So if we take this equation, if tau is an h, you see that f of sigma tau is equal to f of sigma. That's really, really, really nice, because that says that f as a function is constant on the cosets of h in g, which says that it comes from a set theoretic function from g mod h to a.
thus f is induced by a function from g mod h to a, because it's constant on the cosets. Okay, now we switch things around, use exactly the same formula, but now it's sigma in h and tau in g. Okay, so now sigma is in h, so that means that this is zero. So we get f of sigma tau equals sigma f of tau. So we have this equality whenever sigma is in h and tau is in g. And so this is very nice because it says that, so right now we want to show that the image is in the invariance for A under the action of H. So
sigma tau equals f of tau.
Yeah, we need that also. We need that this is f of tau. But it's constant on the cosets, and this is f of tau. So here we're using that sigma tau is in the same h coset as tau. Right? So f of tau is equal to sigma f tau. So in fact, you get that f is induced by a map from g mod h to ah. So we're almost there. All we need to know is that this map satisfies the cocycle condition. But, I mean, it does, because it, as a map from g to a, it satisfies the cocycle condition, and it's induced by a map from g mod h to ah. But this map certainly has to satisfy the cocycle condition if f does. So let's, if we call this map f tilde, then to say that f tilde satisfies the cocycle condition is certainly true if here's our map f. It's a map from g to ah, and in fact it comes from a map from g mod h to ah. And to finish the proof, we need to know that this map satisfies the one cocycle condition. So that means if you take two elements here, then you know, this equality has to be satisfied. But if you take these two elements, you just lift them here, and after lifting, you know that this is satisfied. So it has to be satisfied here. I don't feel like I'm convincing anybody.
It's actually taking just class representatives.
What?
Class representatives.
Yeah, just take class representatives. And yeah, so. When you lift, you're taking two coset representatives. On the coset representatives, this is satisfied, so it's certainly satisfied on the whole coset. So, in fact, the element f, which rests to zero, does come from an element of h1 g mod h ah, which means that the image of inf contains the kernel of res. And we also had the other inclusion, so the image of inf is exactly the kernel of res. Here's one nice, well, the way we're going to apply this later in a slightly more general context is that we'll have this kernel of res, and we'll want to know it's finite. Now, in the context we're considering here, the groups are all finite, so that really doesn't say anything. But in a moment, we're going to consider more general cohomology where these groups aren't necessarily finite, but where this one will be. And the fact that the kernel of res is exactly equal to the image of inf, and this image of inf will be finite just because of the setup, will tell us that the kernel of res will be finite. And that will be a crucial step in the proof of the weak Mordell Weil theorem. So that's the main reason that I'm introducing inf res. And we don't need, for the argument that I just, for Mordell Weil, we won't need that this is injective. But again, you can prove that pretty easily. All right, so we're now done with inflation restriction. And next we'll do section 12.4, which is Galois cohomology.
Okay, so first, some extended notation, or some new notation. Suppose you have an extension L over K, a finite extension of fields, and its Galois. So it's a finite Galois extension. Finite, you know what that means? Galois means normal and separable. These could be number fields, but it's not necessary that they're number fields in this level of generality. Okay, define Hn L over K, and okay, what will we put here? Well, here let's put A. A is a module for the Galois group. So here, let's see, A is a Galois L over K module. So define this to be Hn gal L over K A. So it's notation. It's simply an abbreviated notation where you completely omit the word Galois. So whenever you see one field over the other, the meaning is it's the cohomology for the Galois group of that field over the other field. Okay? So now it's Galois cohomology. Now there's one extra very interesting thing to do, and that's to define, now let's suppose that you have an A, let's say module over Galois group of K-sep over K. So by K-sep I mean the maximal separable extension of K. In the case of a characteristic zero field, this would just be the algebraic closure. In characteristic P, it might not be. But don't worry about characteristic P, unless you know what this means. So, e.g., if characteristic of K is zero, then K sub is equal to K bar. So let A be a module over gal K sub over K. A good example to keep in mind is the group of points on an elliptic curve over Q bar. It's an example of a module over a module for gal q bar over q. Notice that this group is infinite very often, and this module could very well be infinite as well, but we can't just define the Galois cohomology to be the group cohomology with this group, because I haven't defined group cohomology for an infinite group. So this very often is infinite. What's an example where the Galois group is not infinite?
Field's already algebraically closed.
For example, yeah. So if K is Q bar, this is just the trivial group. Or if K is R, the real numbers, this is a group of order 2. So it can easily fail to be infinite, but when K is a number field, for example, this will always be infinite. Okay, so take such a module, and then use the following notation. A of L, this is the fixed points for gal K sub over L. And this is for any subfield L of K sep that contains K. We'll only need this in the case when this is a finite extension, so I'll assume this is finite. Right here, I'll put less than infinity for the degree. So for our purposes, L is a finite extension of K. So again, this is like what you have for an elliptic curve. With an elliptic curve, A would be E of Q bar. So say for an elliptic curve over Q, and then A of L is just E of L, which happens to be E of Q bar, the stuff that's fixed under the Galois group. And the fact that these two are equal is Galois theory for a separable extension. It says that the stuff that's fixed under all automorphisms that fix the field are exactly the things that actually have coordinates that lie in that field. Here, this is a definition, though. And this is just an example. Now, I can finally define the most interesting Galois cohomology object, which is Hn k, a. So this notation means the following. It means you take the direct limit, and I hope I'll say a little more about what that means in case you don't totally know. You take the direct limit over all finite Galois extensions L over K, and we're viewing them as all sitting inside of our fixed choice of a separable closure of K, H N L over K A of L. So here, I'm using two new things. One is the notation A of L, which I just introduced. And the other is the notation HN L over K, and then a module, which I introduced right here. Yes?
Is this profinite limit, or, I mean, why don't we have the arrow backwards?
Because it's not, it's, this is the correct. There are two ways you can put the arrow, and you get two different things. There's no natural way in which to put the arrow the other way here. This is the direct limit, the injective limit, not the projective limit. So, when you construct ZP as the inverse limit of Z mod P to the NZ, you get this huge uncountable thing, and you have all these maps sort of down from the bigger thing to the smaller thing. This is completely the opposite. This is countable. You should think of this almost as a union of these groups. So, maybe I should say something about a few words at least about direct limits. So you define precisely a notion of a directed system where you have a whole bunch of, I guess you can do this in a great deal generally. You'll think about abelian groups. So you have a whole bunch of abelian groups, X sub I, varying over some index set. And this is a, this is an, this set's order, I guess, partially ordered set. And whenever you have two things in this post set, you require that there's a third thing that's bigger than the two things. So now I and J, there's something K that's bigger than or equal to both I and J. And define the directed limit to, well, okay, sorry, I guess you need a little more. You need maps from XI to XK whenever I less than or equal to K. So you have that. And then you define the direct limit of this collection associated to this data to be, I guess you take the union of the elements modulo an equivalence relation. I have to remember this exactly. I'm prepared to define this precisely. But the idea is two elements are equivalent if when you find something that is bigger than, so you have an element of xi and an element of xj, they're equivalent if when you go up high enough they're the same under these maps. So
you need a compatibility there.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm leaving out some stuff. So what the compatibility would be something like this. The diagrams like this commute, yeah. So unfortunately, I didn't prepare for the notes the exact definition of directed system and direct limit, and I might be leaving out some crucial detail. So let me see. I haven't actually written down the definition. I think when I wrote the notes, I naively hoped that everyone would be very happy with the direct limit. Actually, maybe you are all happy with the direct limit. Is anyone not happy with the direct limit? Okay, you're not? Okay, I'm in trouble. Okay. So I think that the direct limit of the xi is the union of the xi modulo an equivalence relation, where alpha and beta, alpha is equivalent to beta. So here alpha is in some xi, beta is in some xj. They're equivalent if there exists a k bigger than or equal to I and j, such that phi I m phi k, such that phi I k alpha is equal to phi I phi j k
space of data.
So I hope I'm not forgetting anything in the definition. So here's how you have such a structure on the collection of these cohomology groups. You fixed in, then for every Galois extension you have this cohomology group. And then how do you get these maps? Well, they're just the res maps. So, or sorry, no, they're the not the res maps, they're the they're the inf maps that we defined before. So here's a way to think about this. So this is like HN gal K sub over K modulo gal K sub over L comma A fixed by gal K sub over L. That's what this is. Because, after all, the Galois group of L over K by Galois theory is the quotient of this Galois group by that Galois group. And the definition of A of L is it's the fixed points for Galois K sub over L. And this has an inflation map to, well, something we haven't defined, but I'm getting in trouble. There's an alternative way to define this that I think I better use because this is perhaps too much of a formalism. You can also just give a topology to gal k sub over k, and then consider continuous co-cycles modulo continuous co-boundaries. And you get exactly the same thing. And I did spend a lot of time discussing a topology on Galois groups, on absolute Galois groups, in the context of Galois representations. So that's an alternative way of doing the same thing. Remark. You can define HN K A to be C N cocycles on gal K sub over K that are continuous. So these have to be continuous. And here you give A the discrete topology. And you give the Galois group the topology where the open, the non-empty open subsets, well, a basis of open neighborhoods of the identity are exactly the these Galois groups right here, or finite extensions. So those are finite index subgroups that are normal, and you declare those to be the open subset. So that contain the identity that are subgroups. So you take continuous cocycles modulo continuous coboundaries, and you give A the discrete topology. What this means is that this has the discrete topology, and this has the topology I just described, any continuous map will have to have finite image. So in fact, it comes via inflation from one of these groups right here. Because this is a finite set. So the cocycle, a cocycle that represents an element of this group will have to have finite image because this is a finite set. So then when you inflate it to get a cocycle on the whole Galois group of K sub over K, you get something that has finite image and hence will be continuous.
Question?
Yes?
Would this definition be meaningful for K cos cube algorithms?
So it's meaningful for absolutely any field at all. And in the case of an algebraically closed field, the cohomology groups are all zero for n greater than or equal to 1. Did that answer your question? And the reason is just because here, if k is q bar, and you're taking a limit over all finite Galois extensions, there aren't any at all, so except for the trivial one. So it's just hn of a single group, which is the zero group, comma whatever, and that's just zero. So a way to think about this direct limit that's very concrete is given an element of this finite cohomology group, this is just this one you shouldn't have too much trouble with. This is just defined in exactly the same way as before, where this is a finite group, the Galois group of L over K, which is the same thing as this Galois group I wrote there by Galois theory. But you can think of every single one of these groups via viewing it this way gives you a subgroup of HNKA defined this way. And if you take them all together, you get HNKA. If you take the union of all of the images under IMF of all of these groups. So the question is, what is an element of HNKA? An element of HNKA is an element of HN L over K AL for some L. And if you take the union of all of these, where there's sort of a natural identification that you might make, then that's what this is. I mean, for example, if you, just to emphasize this natural identification, if you have HN L over K A of L, and then you also consider HN and you take a slightly bigger field, M over K, where M contains L, comma A of M. So here your group is a little bit bigger and your A of M is possibly a little bit bigger, but it could very well be that these are the same. You wouldn't want to consider the elements here totally different than this. That's why you don't take a disjoint union. You take a union where you identify things that somehow come from a common group like this. You identify things if, when you go up to a sufficiently large field, if you embed this HN and another HN in one of these HNs for a sufficiently large M, they become the same. Or completely alternatively and completely equivalently, you just define HNKA to be continuous N cocycles modulo continuous N coboundaries. Or again, in the Mordell Bay theorem, we're only going to use N equals 1, which makes it a bit simpler. Then there are continuous maps from the Galois group to A. Continuous just means it factors through one of these quotients. So that's Galois cohomology. That's the definition of Galois cohomology. It's a functor that associates to a field and a module over the Galois group of that field, a group. And that group collects together the cohomology of each finite extension. And it's incredibly all-embracing idea that you can rephrase a lot of other things in terms of. For example, Brouwer groups are H2 KK bar star. So this is the same as Brouwer groups of fields. Also, H1s, in the sense, classify twists of an object. So for example, if you take an elliptic curve, and consider an elliptic curve E over K, and then consider H1 K, comma, the automorphisms of the elliptic curve that fits the identity element of the elliptic curve. For most elliptic curves, this group is just plus or minus 1, but there are some elliptic curves that have extra automorphisms called CM elliptic curves. And there are also elliptic curves over finite fields that always have more automorphisms than just plus or minus 1. Anyways, the elements of this H1 are in bijection with the twists of the elliptic curve, where a twist of an elliptic curve is another elliptic curve that is not necessarily isomorphic to E over K, but it's isomorphic to E over K-sep. So, amazingly, this very formal-looking definition, there are a huge number of concrete, interesting things like the collection of twists of an object, or a Brouwer group, or other things that can be alternatively interpreted as a cohomology group of this form. So they're really, really interesting to consider.
How do the twists of elliptic curves go?
Sorry, say that again.
How do the twists of an elliptic curve form a group?
Isn't that amazing that they form a group? So, amazingly, they form a group. So, actually, if you could say, here's an example. Let's suppose your curve has automorphisms only plus or minus 1. So just assume that is the case, which is the case for most elliptic curves over Q, for example. Then this cohomology group is isomorphic to K star mod K star squared. So in this particular case, it will be the same as K star mod K star squared. And You might know that if you have an elliptic curve y squared equals x cubed plus ax plus b, you can find another elliptic curve isomorphic by considering the curve dy squared equals x cubed plus ax plus b. This is another curve. It's isomorphic to your first curve, but only over k sep. Actually, it's isomorphic over k adjoined square root of b. So there's another elliptic curve. It's a twist of e. It's not isomorphic to e unless d happens to be a perfect square, but it'll be isomorphic to d over the algebraic closure, or at least over the separable closure. It'll be isomorphic over a bigger field. So if you take the collection of all twists of a fixed elliptic curve, including that fixed elliptic curve itself, amazingly you get a group, and that group is k star mod k star squared. Since the twists are exactly classified by these d's up to squares. So really you're doing the same thing as k star mod k star squared. So that's one example.
So there's an operation to
To add multiple. So if you have an elliptic curve twisted by d and another elliptic curve twisted by d prime, the multiplication of those two twists would be the elliptic curve twisted by d times d prime. And each element is two torsion. If you take the elliptic curve twisted by d and then add it to itself, you get the elliptic curve twisted by d squared, and that's just the identity. So you get back the original curve. Okay, so isn't that amazing? There's this extra structure on the collection of twists of an elliptic curve that you might not know about, but you can explain quite naturally in terms of Galois cohomology. And the really nice thing about this is it works exactly the same way, even if the elliptic curve has extra automorphisms. So, for example, you know about the congruent number problem. There you have elliptic curves y squared equals x cubed minus n squared x. And this particular curve does have extra automorphisms. If you replace x by minus 1, you get So notice that this is still an equality. The minus 1 pops out on the right-hand side of the y. Well, if you put the I squared, you get a minus 1 on the left-hand side. So y goes to iy and x goes to minus x. That's an example of an automorphism of order 4 of this elliptic curve. And you have quadratic twists of this elliptic curve, but you might have more. There's maybe possibly more to understand. Maybe this isn't such a good example, but this group is a little bigger, so the cohomology isn't quite as simple as this. There's also a curve with the Fermat cubic, x cubed plus y cubed equals z cubed. This also defines an elliptic curve. This elliptic curve has an automorphism of order 3, and then the twists are, well, this group ends up having order 6, and you get extra twists that are somewhat form a much more subtle group than just k star mod k star squared. Okay? So it's just nice that you can, you'll see, if you end up doing number 3, you'll see you'll see Galois cohomology constantly in everything you do. It's absolutely crucial. Okay, so that's just motivation for Galois cohomology. So here's an example application of Galois cohomology. So you've probably heard that class field theory explains the abelian extensions of a fixed number field. So for example, the Kronecker-Weber theorem tells you the abelian extensions of Q are all contained in cyclotomic extensions. Someone here is doing a project on Kronecker-Weber. You're doing a project on Kronecker-Weber, for example. So here's a question that we can, without really doing too much work, we can answer just using a little bit of formalism of Galois cohomology. That is, what are the extensions of cyclic extensions of degree dividing n of, so they're abelian, so cyclic abelian extensions of degree dividing n of a fixed number field that contains the nth roots of unity. So if we take a number field that contains the nth roots of unity, then it's easy to classify certain abelian extensions of that field, which is pretty amazing that you can do it, but you can. And we'll see it'll just fall out of an exact sequence, and that's what Kummer theory is really about. Here's a special case, n equals 2. The rational numbers contain the second roots of unity, plus or minus 1. What are the quadratic extensions of Q? Well, you kind of know them. They're all got by adjoining, you know, the square root of a square-free number. So you really understand all the quadratic extensions of Q. Why do you understand them so well? Maybe there are other quadratic extensions of Q. Well, somehow just because of the quadratic formula, you know that that's not the case. This is a generalization of that to any n, the requirement being that you have the nth roots of unity in your base field. This is just going to fall out of chasing an exact sequence and using a little bit of Galois cohomology. So let me show you how this works. And I've seen a lot of examples like this that really makes Gallic cohomology seem sort of familiar and real to you. These groups are very mysterious, though. Like, notice already in this case, this group is infinite. You have infinitely many twists, unless your k is really big. And Brouwer groups, these can be really, really, really complicated. You can also just take h1k e of k, and that's a really, really complicated group. It has infinitely many elements of all order. So these groups are the big Gallic cohomology groups, because after all, they're basically a union of a whole bunch of finite groups, but you really have a lot of them. Okay, so here's Kimmer theory. Okay, so take a field. Let's say it's a number field. Now, if you wanted to try to do something similar for any field at all, you could think about it. You get somewhere. And then take k bar star. K bar is, of course, just q bar here, because k is a number field. And there's an nth powering map, x goes to x to the n, on q bar. And this map is surjective. Why is this map surjective? Right, because the field's algebraically closed. And if you have an element alpha here, then this is surjective if there's some nth root of that. And that's asking, does the polynomial z to the n minus alpha have a root? And of course it does, because this is algebraically closed. The kernel of this map is what I'll call mu n. It's the group of roots of unity of order dividing n. So we have an exact sequence. For any n, you have this exact sequence. Let's assume n is an integer greater than or equal to 2. So whenever you see an exact sequence of modules over the Gallo group, you've got to take Gallo cohomology. So here, these are modules over Gal q bar over k. So k is our fixed number field. So we have to take Gallic cohomology, and let's see what we get. So first you take you have the h0s, then you have the h1s, then the h2s, and so on. So first 1, and then mu n of k. So by this I mean all of the nth roots of unity that happen to be in k. In a moment, I'm going to make the assumption that all of them are in k, and that will simplify the sequence a lot. So you have mu n of k, then you have k star, then you have k star, and this is the nth powering map. Alpha goes to alpha to the n. Then you have here h1 k mu n of k bar, sorry. Then you have h1 k k bar star. And then you have h1 k k bar star. And here this is the nth multiplication by n map, because we usually think of these additively. So I'll just put an n here. And then you have h2 k mu n, etc. And one thing that I didn't state is that for Gallic cohomology, you also have a long exact sequence. And you get it just from the long exact sequences on this level. And you put them all together and you get a long exact sequence here. By the way, this formalism of Gallic cohomology is, I think, was first introduced in a paper of Lange and Tate in 1955, which is actually a really nice paper to read. One of those read the master papers. But it makes sense because it's sort of very clear and it's the first paper. It's called Gallic cohomology, I think, for abelian varieties. But I think they just start by talking about Gallic cohomology in general. So I think it's a very nice paper. And it's easy to find a scanned version, I think, on JSTOR, on my website. So that's a good reference if you want to learn about this right. So here's your exact sequence. And it keeps going a long ways. So for example, the next one would be H2K K bar star, which is the Brouwer group of K, and so on. So from this, there's one thing you can get. Whenever you have an exact sequence like this, and this is just this n here, you can just pull out from this a short exact sequence, which is actually an isomorphism. Let's
see, what do we get? We get k star mod k star to the n that that's isomorphic to, so the co-kernel of this is isomorphic to the kernel of that. The co-kernel of this map, which is this, k star mod k star to the n, is isomorphic to the kernel of this. Actually, it's not so clear what the kernel of that is, so...
Don't you want to use Hilbert's 90?
Yeah, I forgot to use Hilbert's 90. Hilbert's 90 says it's a zero. That is a very good point. Thank you. So, this is isomorphic to H1 K U N K bar. And the fact that Hilbert's 90 says this is zero is one of the homework problems, so I won't do it. But just to sketch in words so you don't get sort of lost, you can reduce this to the case of L over K, a finite extension, and then L bar star here, and then use the linear independence of automorphisms in a little trick, which is described completely in, say, Serre's book Local Fields, and you get that this is zero. It really is very elementary, assuming you have linear independence of automorphisms, which is a completely standard statement from a Galois theory course. So you have this as a homework problem. If you want to look it up in Serre's book, that's perfectly fine with me. So you have this isomorphism, and you might ask, okay, what's the use of that? That doesn't tell us anything about abelian extensions. And it's not so clear what this says, but if you make the assumption that mu n of k bar, that mu n is contained in k bar, is contained in k, sorry. It should be mu n of, yes, that's right. Okay, so now assume, we're going to make an additional assumption that mu n is contained in k. So this is like the assumption that mu 2 plus or minus 1 is contained in q. It's a generalization of that assumption. If you make that assumption, then this is a trivial Galois module. The action of gal k sep over k on mu n, because we're assuming all the nth roots of unity are already in k, is just trivial. Everything acts as the identity. And remember, h1s are really easy. Well, at least they become something simpler when the module is trivial, when it's acted on by the identity. Then it's just a Hom group. So under this assumption, we have that k star by k star to the n is isomorphic to Hom from the Galois group of k bar over k to mu n. And there you are. Now, this is really nice. What this says is that the homomorphisms with image contained in a cyclic group of order n are exactly the same as elements of k star mod k star to the n. So now if you just interpret this correctly, this classifies the cyclic abelian extensions of k, whose Galois group is contained in mu n, that is, whose Galois group has order dividing n. So let me tell you why that's the case. So first let's think a little bit, I'll just try to explain why that's the case. So suppose you have some Galois extension of k with Galois group that's cyclic of degree dividing n. So this is g, and it's a cyclic group, c sub m, where m divides n. Then the Galois group of L over k by Galois theory is a quotient of gal k bar over k. And our assumption that it's cyclic of order dividing n means it's contained in mu n, where this is just, or just think of this as an abstract group of order n. There's some map into mu n. So anytime you give a Galois extension, which has Galois group that's cyclic, order dividing n, if you choose an embedding of that Galois group into mu n, you get a homomorphism with image in mu n. So anytime you have a cyclic Galois extension of k, you have one of these homomorphisms. Actually, you have several different homomorphisms. You have homomorphisms up to automorphisms of un. We only have finitely many of those, and you can understand those easily. So for example, whenever you have a quadratic extension, you have a homomorphism from the Galois. If you have a quadratic extension of q, you have a homomorphism from gal q bar over q to mu 2, which is just, you send the gal, first you choose an Well, you don't have to choose anything. You just have the Galois group of Q bar over Q maps to the Galois group of your quadratic extension, which is always canonically isomorphic to Z mod 2Z. So, but in general, this also works. So amazingly, the cyclic abelian extensions, which are classified by the thing on the right, modulo automorphisms of this image, which is simple, are exactly the same as K star mod K star to the n. So you might think, okay, what's the use of that? I mean, K star mod K star to the n is really complicated. What in the heck is that? Well, think about it in the case of, say, Q. What is Q star mod Q star squared? It's not really that complicated, because Q star is just the just plus or minus 1 cross the free abelian group on the primes. That's what Q star is. You have a sign, and then you have an element of Q star is just a list of primes with exponents, and it's just a free abelian group on those, plus you have sign. And in general, K star by K star to the n, it's a little bit more complicated. The complexity, for example, having to do with the class group of K, but it's not really that much more complicated than the free abelian group on the primes plus some sign. So in the case of Q, though, this is really simple. It's just a countable direct sum of copies of F2. That's what it is in the case of Q. You're taking, if you take Q star mod Q star squared, again, you have a sign, and then you have anything in this quotient group you can write as a product of distinct primes, plus or minus a product of distinct primes. That's exactly the same thing as plus or minus a square free integer. So you see how this is exactly classifying the quadratic extensions of Q. So the quadratic extensions of Q has a group structure. If you take the collection of quadratic extensions of Q along with Q itself, that's an abelian group, which maybe you didn't know until just now. So it's an abelian group because it is the abelian group Q star mod Q star squared. But more generally, if you have a field K, any number field K at all, and the nth roots of unity are contained in K, then the extensions of degree dividing n that are cyclic abelian, which are almost the same thing as homomorphisms like this, that has a group structure, and that group structure is K star mod K star to the n. So this classifies those abelian extensions. And explicitly, here's how the map works. If you have an element on the left-hand side, you can represent it by an element of K star. So if you have an alpha here, then what you do is you give an alpha in here, so it's something modulo nth powers, you choose a beta, so the beta to the n, here beta is in K bar star, and beta to the n equals alpha, and then you map alpha to the homomorphism, which sends sigma to sigma beta over beta. And that's an explicit homomorphism from here to here. And also, beta itself gives you the field that corresponds to this element alpha is just got by adjoining beta to K. So this corresponds to K joining beta. So here you have to choose. So the field doesn't depend on your choice. So here, when you choose, you're choosing modulo nth roots of unity. The homomorphism will depend on which nth root of alpha that you choose. The field doesn't, because K already contains all the nth roots of unity. So if you adjoin one nth root of unity, it's the same as adjoining any other nth root of unity. So really what Kummer theory says is that the extensions, the abelian cyclic extensions of degree dividing n, are all got by adjoining nth roots of elements of K star. Because that's how you get this cocycle here. So it's just exactly the analog of what you have for quadratic extensions. Quadratic extensions, you're adjoining square roots of numbers, modulo squares of numbers. In general, if you have a number field K that contains the nth roots of unity, the abelian extensions that are cyclic of degree dividing n are got by adjoining nth roots of elements of your base field, modulo nth powers. That's it. So that's Kummer theory. And again, it just falls really out of this exact sequence. So you start with this exact sequence, which is the nth powering sequence. You take Galois cohomology, you get the long exact sequence, you use Hilbert's theorem 90, which says that this is zero, then you get VH1 is the same as K star mod K star to the n, and then H1 in the under the assumption that mu n is contained in K, this is the same as Hom. Hom classifies the abelian extensions of the automorphisms of your mu n, and that is in bijection with K star mod K star to the n. Okay? Alright, so now let's, in order to get the Mordell Bay theorem, you basically do the same thing except for you do it with an elliptic curve instead of a number field. There are a few non-trivial preliminary remarks in order to prove the weak Mordell Bay theorem, which are essentially refinements of this business right here. So I think I'm going to, I'll assume theorem 12.5.1. Theorem 12.5.1 says is that, well, okay, so I've told you something about the extensions of degree n of k. So what if you do something more? What if you bound the ramification? So you take only extensions of degree n, and they have to be unramified outside of some finite set of primes. Then how can you classify those? Well, there's a certain subgroup of this that you define. It's defined, let's see, on page 127. It's called KSN. And this subgroup gives rise to all of the extensions that are unramified outside of a given finite set of primes. So if you fix a finite set of primes, you define a subgroup of this that gives rise to this extent of those. It gives rise to those. Then the neat thing you can do is prove that if you enlarge S sufficiently, that the subgroup is a quotient of a group of units, and it's also a torsion group. So because of Dirichlet's unit theorem, and the fact that a finitely generated torsion group is finite, you see that the group that classifies all of the finite extensions unramified outside of some finite set is itself a finite group. It's itself a finite group. So if you have a field K, then the abelian extensions that are unramified outside of some finite set and have Galois group that's contained in mu n, that's a finite collection of abelian extensions. That's really the crucial input to proving the weak Mordell Bay theorem. So what I'm going to do is assume that now and then prove it on Tuesday, since we only have a few minutes. But that will be something that will take us a bit of work. But I can do pretty much all the details of that proof here, except for one thing. So what I'll do now is sketch the idea of how you apply what I just said to prove the weak Mordell Bay theorem. So again, what I just said in one sentence is that if you have a number field K and it contains the nth roots of unity, then if you fix a finite set S of primes of K and then consider the abelian extensions of exponent abelian extensions of Galois group contained in UN unramified outside of S, you get a finite set of abelian extensions. So that's it. And that uses really as input the finiteness of the class group and the Dirichlet unit theorem. So just idea, or how about outline of weak Mordell Bay. Which we'll finish next Tuesday. So weak Mordell Bay says the following. This says that if you have an elliptic curve over a number field K, and n is an integer greater than or equal to 2, then e of k mod n e of k is finite. So that's what weak Mordell Bay says. And here's the idea of the proof.
In your notes, it's
yes.
Finitely generated. Is that?
Well, it's a torsion group, so. Finitely generated implies finite trivially. So I should change it to say finite in the notes.
So here's the idea of the proof. You consider the following exact sequence. 0, the intorsion of E, E, multiplication by N, E, 0. This is exactly analogous to the sequence we considered over here. Also, you can assume the analog of the statement that mu n is contained in k. The analog of this statement is that all the nth roots of unity, all the nth roots of 0 on the elliptic curve, that is to say en, is defined over k. So you can assume en of k is equal to en k bar. This just means that the coordinates of the n torsion points actually are elements of k. And the reason you can assume this is because you have an exact sequence that goes 0, h1, k, en over k, en, h1, k, en, h1, l, en. So here, l is k, en. By k, en, I mean, take the field k, take the x and y coordinates of all the elements of en, and then adjoin them to k, and you get a big field, big Galois extension of k. And that's what I mean by this field. So you have this sequence. This is exactly the inference sequence translated into the language of Galois cohomology. And this is finite because this is a finite group right here. And we know that H1's for a finite group, that has to be finite since the elements are one cocycles, and there are only finitely many one cocycles since they're maps from this finite set over here to this finite group. So this is finite. And by exactness of this sequence, this finite group is the kernel of this map. And here you have all the nth roots of unity in this field of k of en. Yep, sorry, not the nth roots of unity, but the nth roots of 0 on the elliptic curve. So you can go from here to here, and this has a finite kernel. So Well, in order to see why that's relevant, I think I need to take the long exact sequence associated to this sequence. So you take this sequence, and then from that you get 0, well, cut to the chase, you get E of k by n E of k that injects into h1 k E n, and then you have h1 k E n. And then it keeps going. But actually, this is 0, because I put the n there. So again, this is an analog of something we saw before. This is just like k star mod k star to the n injects into the h1, except this isn't 0 in general. This is actually quite big. You don't have a Hilbert's theorem 90 for the elliptic curve. So you go from here to here. And what you do is you prove that the image of E of k mod n E of k in here is finite, assuming that En, that all the points in En are defined over k. But if they weren't, you could just go up to H1 k En, En, prove everything up here. Let me just call this field L. E L mod N E L. So you can go up like that. This map has finite kernel. That's what's described right here. This is the res map. So this has finite kernel. So to prove that this is finite, you first map here. That's an inclusion. Then you map up via this finite kernel. And it suffices to prove the image of this up here is finite, that image is contained in the image this way. So you can reduce to the case that you're just working with L.
your base field contains all the end torsion. So then you have the new problem. How do you show when the base field contains all the end torsion that this is finite? That, I mean, the image of this in here is finite. And here's how it works. When your base field contains all the end torsion points of the elliptic curve, then this is just Hom gal k bar over L into En, where En is just z mod nz. As an abelian group, it's just z mod nz squared. And in the same way over here, that abelian extensions with their subgroup, with their Galois group contained in mu n, correspond to homomorphisms, this corresponds to abelian extensions whose Galois group is contained in z mod nz squared. And the neat thing is that you can explicitly describe the map from E of L mod N E of L over here, and it turns out that you get homomorphisms so that correspond to fields that are unramified outside of the primes of bad reduction for the elliptic curve and N. And that collection of fields, by Kummer theory, plus a little bit more, is finite. So there can be only finitely many things that are in E of L mod N E of L, so this has to be finite. So this gives you a subgroup of this with bounded ramification. And hence a finite subgroup of that. So that's a sketch of how weak Mordell Bay is proved in general. And the details to fill in are why do you get bounded ramification here? This is certainly a non-trivial fact. And why are the collection of homomorphisms that correspond to fields with bounded ramification, why is that set finite? But both of these things follow, for the most part, from things we've done earlier in the course. This bounded ramification, there's one point where you have to use injectivity of reduction on torsion points to give a proof of bounded ramification. And that's a very natural statement, but I won't be able to develop the theory of formal groups in here in order to prove it. Okay, so on Tuesday, I'm going to fill in the details both over here and there. Also, of course, you can read them in the notes in the meantime, since everything is here. And a reminder, on Thursday, I won't be here, but Andre will be, and he's going to talk about how you go from the weak Mordell Bay theorem, which says this is finite, to the strong Mordell Bay theorem. At least, assuming finiteness of the torsion subgroup.
One more, that's short.
What?
That's short, more than that.
And what else are you going to do?
You said you were going to
I didn't injectivity of reduction.
So how about that? Just get a little
So the two things I admit are proof of the S-unit theorem and injectivity of reduction.
Well, first of all,
you can prove the S-unit theorem using almost, I mean, using exactly the same ideas as the proof of the unit theorem. I mean, the proof is identical pretty much, so I'm not sure that's worth doing. But definitely the injectivity of reduction on torsion is worth doing.